Welcome to Vegan Nation. I'm your host, Marlena Massachusetts. Vegan Nation is an informational program featuring vegan music, news, events, and interviews about the vegan evolution revolution happening worldwide, manifesting freedom, peace, health, wellness, and sustainability. The views in this program do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the station nor its management. I'd like to thank all our listeners for tuning in to Vegan Nation. We're very fortunate to be joined by Shelley Harrison. He is a vegan, an inventor, and a law and logic professor. Thank you very much, Shelley, for joining us on Vegan Nation.
Hello, Marlene. So grateful to be included on Vegan Nation and on WCUW today. How's the holiday season treating you so far?
Wonderful. Thank you very much. How about you?
Doing fine.
Good. Well, I am very much looking forward to this interview. Wow. Thank you for all you contribute to this world.
And same to you. I am just so grateful for you.
Thank you. So I understand that you were granted what appear to be the first U.S. patents dedicated to vegans and animal rights activists. Can you tell me more about that?
Definitely. So the U.S. patent system is constitutional in origin, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. So this is something that the founders, the U.S.'s founders, took very seriously. And so it's been around since that time. And it's an influential publication throughout the world. And I wanted to take the opportunity to use this kind of unique and enduring publication system as a way to communicate the animal rights message out there to the world in an enduring way and into circles that might not previously have been exposed to animal rights-related types of ideas. So that was kind of the reason for getting those dedications to animal rights activists fit into the patents.
Thank you, Shelley. I am now going to take this opportunity to quote the dedications for the two U.S. patents for which you, Shelley Harrison, were granted. Quote, U.S. Patent 8218207. The inventor wishes to thank animal rights activists worldwide for opposing the torture of animals in laboratories. Institutionalized animal torture, animal research, animal testing, or vivisection, has no legitimate place in actual science. Rather, those who torture animals in labs should be criminally prosecuted just as any other animal abusers. It is well established that actual scientists do not experiment on living beings without first obtaining informed consent. The absence of such consent renders modern scientists who perform research on animals indistinguishable from other serial killers such as Joseph Mengele. Similarly, it is equally well established that actual doctors adhere to the first principle of medical ethics, primum non nocere, or first, do no harm. Having departed from this principle, doctors who perform research on animals are categorically unfit to call themselves doctors. End quote. Quote, U.S. Patent 7905769, now owned by Microsoft. The inventor wishes to thank animal rights activists worldwide for opposing blood sports, such as dogfighting, bullfighting, fox hunting, and other forms of violence, sickness, and cowardice. While actual games and sports, such as those disclosed herein, are fun and challenging, blood sports cannot even be legitimately called sports, since there is no courage or challenge involved in torturing or killing a creature who is unsuspecting, unarmed, trapped, and innocent. Blood sports are, accordingly, the exclusive province of the weak, the craven, and the depraved. End quote. Those statements are now preserved in the U.S. patent database forever. Shelley Harrison. Thank you. Can you tell me more about that with the dedications?
Well, just that, getting those into the patent database was something that I wanted to take advantage of that opportunity just because it is the kind of thing that has circulated worldwide. It is the kind of thing that's going to, endure as long as the U.S. endures and it reaches into circles that are not often exposed necessarily to or concerned about things like animal rights. So it seemed like a really good opportunity to just get those in there. When you file an invention specification, you're free to word it however you wish. And so I just thought that I would use that opportunity for these dedications.
Which of your inventions is your favorite?
First, whenever you ask an inventor that their first thought is always whatever they're working on currently, of course. But I have always been a fan of Dungeons & Dragons and Harry Potter and fantasy literature in general, and actually taught a fantasy literature class at Memphis University School for a while. And I guess one time in the early 2000s, I was kind of dreaming about how nice it would be to have an actual working magic wand like those in Harry Potter or D&D. And I had been working on some speech recognition and motion sensor products at that time and went ahead and used those kinds of technologies and approaches to create a fully functioning magic wand. The story with that one is kind of fun as well. I don't know if you would want me to go into a little bit of how that invention moved forward. Does that sound like a good thing to talk about briefly?
Yes.
So a few weeks after I got the patent, I got a letter in the mail, a physical letter from a company I'd never heard of. And when you get a new patent, you get kind of buried with these invention marketing companies and so on. And a lot of them are a little bit shady. So I was about to throw the letter away, but they kind of sounded for real. So I thought, you know, better safe than sorry, I would respond to them. And then as discussions went forward, it became clear that they were real. So I had my attorney up in the Bay Area negotiate with them, and we signed the contract without knowing who was going to countersign, because this company that had contacted me was actually one of these intermediary companies. The big companies don't want you to know that they're interested in your patent for a number of legal and business reasons. So they work through these kind of anonymous entities. And so that's what this company was, a sort of, you know, just unknown entity that was working for some big company. And since it's a magic wand for video game controllers, I was thinking it was probably one of the three big console makers, so Sony or Microsoft or Nintendo. So we signed the document, you know, we signed the contract, we send it off to wondering who's going to sign, and then the Fukushima earthquake happened in Japan, and we didn't hear back for several weeks, and I was concerned. I had a previous invention, actually my first fully funded startup, was effectively kind of put out of business by the attacks of September 11th, and so when the Fukushima earthquake happened, I thought, well, you know, maybe this thing is going to kill the deal as well. But as it turned out, we eventually got back a few weeks later after some anxiety. We got back a letter, and it was actually from Microsoft. So Microsoft is now the owner of the Magic Wand, although unfortunately they have not launched it for the Xbox. I guess they just had purchased it to get it away from the competition. That's at least what some companies do. But anyway, it was a fun story to have it move forward in that way and finally get bought it by a company who could eventually launch it.
Thank you, Shelley. How did you wind up becoming an inventor?
As a young person, I was personally into studying and learning about everything. I was into dinosaurs like so many kids, and that eventually kind of opened the door to geology and astronomy and biology, all kind of relating in there to dinosaurs and just studying animals, you know, historically. And then I collected rocks and fossils and coins and stamps. And then by the time I got to college, I was mainly focused on poetry and music and theater and art history. Majored in English at Stanford and spent a lot of time studying art history there. And most of my time, I guess, went into music and theater, and that has been the case many times since then. But I would just say that the background of just wide-ranging across, you know, the sciences, yes, it's crucial that you leverage the sciences and engineering and math and computer programming as an inventor, but they don't necessarily create or, you know, engage you in the creative process and in the problem-solving process any more than the humanities do. A person who's trying to create a new form of dance or cinematography or a song or a painting or a screenplay or whatever, those people are also being inventive. Reaching outside of the just technical fields and equally embracing these other fields, you know, the creative arts and so on, is, I think, a crucial part of the inventing process. The patent system, of course, and the copyright system, our intellectual property system in general, definitely recognizes patents as being, you know, for physical items that have a functionality, whereas copyright and trademark are more about communicative items. But the fact that the legal system treats them that way doesn't mean that the creative process is limited to those things. And so, again, just ranging across one's kind of full spectrum of human activity, I think, is an engaging one's curiosity is a big part of inventing, and that certainly is what I think is the part of my background that got me into that space. I never set out to be an inventor, just kind of more woke up and realized I was one just from kind of doing it all the time.
We're listening to Shelley Harrison, an inventor, a vegan, and a law and logic professor. Shelley is joining us via Skype. You're tuned into Vegan Nation. I'm your host, Marlene in Massachusetts. We'll be taking a short break, and then we'll continue our conversation with Shelley Harrison. From the break. Thank you very much for joining us on Vegan Nation. I'm your host, Marlene in Massachusetts. We're joined by inventor Shelley Harrison. He's also a law and logic professor. Thanks again, Shelley, for joining us on Vegan Nation.
Thank you, Marlene. So good to talk to you.
The social media news feed has sort of taken over the world, with everyone from U.S. presidents to giant corporations and nonprofit organizations using it to circulate their views to literally billions of people worldwide. Can you tell me more about how that invention came about?
With that invention, it was kind of born out of another project. And so my first specific effort at inventing a new product, you know, like we just talked about, I had done poetry, music, and so on. But in terms of a new product that I was intentionally trying to create or whatever, the first of those was called the Sun Scroll. And the idea there was to take those little, you know, those little liquid crystal displays that were at the top of calculators in the 1980s, there was just one little sliver up there and you could just read a bunch of digits across it. The idea was to take that LCD, make it the full face of an electronic device, and then instead of just that one little sliver for text, and then attach that to a big battery and a storage device so that you could have a portable electronic book, or, you know, what we would now call an electronic book reading device or whatever. And so you could just load books in there and carry those around instead of having to carry around big physical paper books. It also came with a solar panel. That's why the name Sun Scroll. The battery and storage were much, much smaller. The capacity for those things was much smaller than it is today, many orders of magnitude smaller. And so having a big solar panel was also part of making it portable, or at least that was the theory there. But at the time, talking it around, people were just not into it. you know, they were like, why would you carry around this electronic thing when you could just carry a real book? So by the mid-90s, I guess, that device, the Sun Scroll, had kind of moved forward to be a sort of complete device where it would not only be your book reading device, but also your phone, your web browser, your email program, your applications, and that kind of thing. And my company called Orangutan called itself that because what our kind of vision was, we would take this kind of thing we called the convergence phone, because all those things, the reading device, the phone, and so on, are just going to be in this one handheld device. And we called it the convergence phone. All those activities are converging into this one product. And Orangutan, the vision for that company, was to liberate people from their desks, you know, so they could just walk around with this one little handheld thing, not have to have a laptop, not have a desktop computer, just, you know, conduct your business from the beach or whatever. And by then, the Apple Newton had been launched, so that kind of showed the general form factor of having a big flat panel display in a little portable handheld device was something that people were at least open to and interested in. But as we were pitching it around in Silicon Valley, the convergence phone, the big kind of response we would get from venture capitalists at that time was that phones are curved. If you can imagine it, the response was just that phones are curved. Instead of having this flat panel display that you'd hold in your hand, they couldn't believe that people would hold a flat panel display because they're used to having phones. You know, old handsets were indeed curved, and old cell phones were indeed curved. And so the idea that people would just talk on a flat phone sounded untenable to the Silicon Valley folks at that time. So we were actually never able to fully get the orangutan convergence phone off the ground. And I just couldn't believe, I kind of want to write an article one day called Phones Are Curved about how we were not able to get this project off the ground to get people's buy-in. But by 1998, I had to step away from orangutan and went down to a friend of mine's place in Sunnyvale, California, just kind of recuperate. I was so disappointed. I couldn't believe that we weren't able to get that project to go. And I just went there as a sort of place to recoup. And my thought was at the time that if we could have simply gotten the convergence phone out to consumers, if we could have gone directly to consumers and said, hey, you can have this one device that does everything type thing, and it's just completely portable and handheld, I felt like if we could get that to consumers, they would have gone for it, and we could have just bypassed the need to work through other, you know, we could build a fan base, basically, without having to first raise that capital, and then as we raised capital, then we would, you know, already have this built-in fan base. And that was the genesis of the news feed. It was just a way to, you know, allow people to talk directly to their followers. People, you know, you could just post something and it would be immediately seen in real time by people who were subscribing to your news feed. We, you know, now we take that kind of thing for granted because we've got Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn and Instagram. But at the time, real-time news feeds and tickers were something that only big companies use, you know, particularly those like those stock tickers that you see being used by on Wall Street. That's one of the original tickers, and even was actually a physical piece of, you know, ticker tape and so on at one time. And so real-time news was really a thing for big companies at that time. And we even called, or, you know, my original name for what we now call the social media news feed was the iTicker, because it was that same kind of real-time thing. But individuals could use it now instead of having to go through some big company. So that's kind of that's the genesis of how we now have the social media news feed. It is now licensed to Facebook and Instagram. I'm a little bummed about how it has sort of been hijacked. These days, Facebook only sends your posts to a very small percentage of your subscribers. You know, a lot of people will have noticed this, of course. If you run a Facebook page, you might have 10,000 subscribers, but any given post only gets seen by 200 of your 10,000 subscribers, and then you got to pay Facebook to boost the post to get to more of your own subscribers. And that's exactly not what the original intent was. The point was to bypass gatekeepers and go straight to your followers, you know, for free, just being able to talk directly to them. If you had 10,000 followers, then you should be able to just post and get it to all 10,000 followers. So that's kind of been a disappointment. The other big disappointment has just been that the news feed has been used to create a bunch of social problems and misinformation out there in our culture. You know, it's just almost sort of Wild West at a lot of times. It's a little bit better now than it was a few years ago, but it's still very Wild West in terms of all kinds of misinformation or hate posts and these kind of things that the news feed has been used for. And in the original specifications, there were a lot of, you know, protections and tools built in, but those have largely not gotten deployed. And so the news feed is still kind of a bit of a free-for-all out there right now. So those two things, I guess, have been disappointing. But overall, I mean, it's been wonderful to see it, you know, succeed to the degree that it has.
Thank you, Shelley. How has your background as an inventor impacted your vegan activism, animal rights activism?
Okay, yeah, definitely in several ways. Well, the first thing that comes to mind would be that I have gotten to see firsthand now a few times over where a vision will go from, you know, the very first point in time when it is regarded as dumb or pointless to another point in time where that idea has become universally accepted. It's very commonly the case that when you invent a new thing, people will think it's dumb. People have a sort of inherent resistance to change. They have an inherent resistance to new ideas. Even if they feel like they're open, they're usually kind of invested in how things are previously done. I think there's a bunch of psychological reasons, but whatever the case, when you're first coming out with a new idea, there tends to be a whole lot of resistance. And then until it succeeds, you yourself as the inventor will be kind of regarded as dumb and silly. Then when the thing goes big, you're regarded as having done something that was obvious. And that's what I call the inventor's curse, actually. You're regarded as a sort of fool right up until the idea goes big. And then as soon as it goes big, everyone says, oh, that was obvious. And, you know, why did you, you know, have to go through all this inventive process when anybody could have done that type thing? So that's just kind of the experience of an inventor. But to the activism point in particular, I've gotten to see, for instance, with the orangutan company, the orangutan vision is now the world we live in. People are out there walking around. We called it technology for primates to liberate people from their desktops and laptops so that they could just walk around with this one device, talk on the phone, get their email, web browser, all that stuff. That is the orangutan vision, and that is the world we live in now because of smartphones. You know, there's literally billions of people worldwide doing that kind of thing, walking around. Their entire electronic connection is through the convergence phone, and they don't even have desktops or laptops anymore. A lot of young people don't even have regular computers with keyboards and so on, and that is the orangutan vision, and it is the world we live in now. So that's an example of getting to see something go all the way from just, you know, an idea that's kind of quirky and silly to becoming pretty much universally accepted. Same kind of thing with the news feed. In that particular case, by the time I was able to move forward with it, it basically went from a point in time where the news feed was just that original idea to the point where it is now, where you've got pretty much global acceptance here in companies like Facebook and Instagram and all the ancillary industries that they have given rise to. So, you know, there are entire companies out there now, entire positions at companies that manage your social media news feed and presence and so on. So even though... Well, and in particular, I remember walking around the block in Culver City, walking around the block after the final patent documents had been filed. I remember walking around and thinking, that is how it's going to be. That's going to be a dominant form of communication in our culture one day. I can't prove it at this time, but I know it to be true. And I specifically remember that little walk in Culver City Park, and that is the case now. You know, I mean, it is literally the case that there are billions of people out there on a monthly basis using the news feed. So I've gotten to see that happen at least in those two occasions for sure. Also, the Sun Scroll is similar to that in terms of electronic books. Once the Kindle came out, it was a similar kind of experience. But and so for activism, when the Abolition Amendment and the Humane Party came along in 2009, I had already gotten to see an idea go from being silly and dumb to being worldwidely accepted. And that is definitely the case with the Abolition Amendment and with abolitionist political parties. They seemed dumb in 2009, certainly, and a lot of people think it's still dumb. But I am much more confident about the Abolition Amendment going big and abolition. The concept, whether it's that particular amendment, who cares? But the concept of abolition and the concept of ending animal exploitation throughout our culture and throughout this world, those things can be much more confidently known to definitely be coming about one day than even the news feed or the smartphone. I mean, after all, there's no existential reason for humanity to have, you know, embraced the smartphone or the news feed. But with abolition and with the ending of animal exploitation, you're talking about ending the number one anthropogenic cause of environmental degradation. You're talking about the number one ethical issue facing our country and our planet. All of those things are going to drive the eventual adoption of the Abolition Amendment or some version of that, not only in the U.S., but in all the other countries eventually, because we're going to have to. So So even more so than something that's optional, like the smartphone or the newsfeed, this is something that's coming along with certainty. And so I guess as an inventor, having gotten to see things move from idea to kind of full fruition, despite all the, you know, being called that you're crazy and foolish and silly and all that, it has given me the kind of confidence to know that just because other people don't agree doesn't mean that the vision you've got is, you know, not correct, because you can definitely have the right vision and still not be, you know, have that vision accepted by people early in the process. They will eventually accept it. They will eventually come around, and that's what we've gotten to see in other occasions, and that certainly is going to be the case on the ending of animal exploitation. With respect to that in particular, this is not unlike the groundswell of the ending of human slavery that happened in the 1700s and 1800s. It kind of took, you know, it swept through a good portion of the world, including the UK and the US, once that idea had come. So we will definitely see that. And I guess that being an inventor is what has given me the ability to just know to stay in there, keep working on it, do not abandon that vision simply because other people can't see it yet.
Wonderful. Thank you, Shelley. We're coming to a close in the interview for today. What additional messages do you have for our listeners?
Well, I would just encourage people to vigorously and rigorously pursue your curiosity, that desire to just know and understand everything around you. And you probably have the impulse to make those things better. And allowing yourself to range across a wide array of disciplines rather than forcing yourself to stay in some sort of prepackaged compartment. You know, your brain is not designed to stay in one of those compartments, in my view. And that is a big part of being an effective inventor. So I would just encourage people to be confident that your brain is not designed to stay in that little box, even if the rest of the world is trying to get you to move into a little box and just stay there forever. That's kind of my parting thought, I guess.
Thank you very much, Shelley. And again, thank you very much for joining us on Vegan Nation, and thank you for all you do.
Thank you so much, Marlene, and I hope you are going to have a wonderful rest of the holidays. It's so good to talk to you, and just looking forward to hearing your show again next time.
Thank you. I'd like to thank all our listeners for tuning in to Vegan Nation. Please join us again next week at the same time. The views and opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the station nor its management. You can hear this program again at vegansradio.com. Let's go out with the music of Benjamin Zephaniah. Rest in peace, Benjamin. He passed away a couple weeks ago. Poet, vegan activist.
Stop the war, stop the war. Military powers, we know who you are. You cannot dictate with your blood and your hair, cause peaceful people fight the steer. Stop the war, stop the war. For certain death is near, not far. Hypocrites drive to Geneva in car, pretending them want to stop the war. Cause what we want is love and unity. We want to live together as a happy family. We are citizens of this world, you see, and a peaceful life is a birthright to we.
We are the vegans and we